Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter. Pretty good Bible studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 18 through 44. In this second half of chapter 4, we will see Elisha raising the Shunammite woman's son from the dead, and we'll see some other miracles that he will perform. Our context is this: in the first 17 verses of 2 Kings chapter 4, in our last audio, we saw Elisha multiplying the widow's oil, and we also see Elisha meeting the Shunammite woman and her preparing a room for him to stay in. So now we're ready to start with 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 18 through 21. And Elisha, by the way, prophesied mainly during the times of Joram, the northern king, the second son of Ahab. And Joram's dates were from 852 to 841. So that gives us our approximate time frame. So we start now in 2 Kings 4, verses 18 through 21. The child, and this is the child that Elisha promised the Shunammite woman that she would have, because Elisha was trying to be nice to her because the Shunammite woman had set up a room for him to stay in and he didn't have money to give her. He tried to offer a position in the government for her husband, or maybe in the military for her husband. She wasn't interested in that. She didn't want to move from Shunem. So he said, okay, I'll tell you what. Boom, and miraculously, he bequeathed on her a child through Yahweh. So this is the child that we're talking about here. Verse 18, the child grew and one day went out to his father and the harvesters. Suddenly he complained to his father, my head, my head. His father told his servant, carry him to his mother. So he, the servant, picked him up and took the boy to his mother. The child sat on her lap until noon and then died. Then she, the Shunammite woman, went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, on Elisha's bed, in that special upper chamber that she and her husband had built for Elisha. She put the boy on Elisha's bed, shut him in, and left. Now this boy grew from the time he was born. Some people speculate he's about 6 or 7 or so. What was he doing in the field? Maybe he just went for recreation, for diversion, went to watch his father in the field. His father was probably there because it was harvest time. And even though his father was a wealthy man, he went out to direct business at the time of the harvest. Or I probably should say, because he was a wealthy man, he's taking care of business. Remember, the Shunammite woman was a prominent woman in verse 8 in this chapter tells us that. So her husband was probably wealthy. The boy goes out, he's probably playing, and nobody's paying much attention to him, and all of a sudden, he grabs his head and says, my head, my head. Sounds like a sunstroke to me. Could be the heat. It's harvest time. It's getting to be springtime, heading on towards summer. Got hot, and the kid got overheated. I live in a hot climate in South Carolina, and you have to be careful about that. You start getting lightheaded, and things start spinning around a little bit. You got to get inside, out of the sun. Well, the little boy has probably a heat stroke or a sunstroke. So her mother, who I'm sure was in great distress, picks the boy up and holds him, hoping he would be all right. But by midday, about noon, the boy dies. So she runs up and lays the boy on the bed of Elisha. Now, there's some options as to why she might have done that. First of all, perhaps she thought that the bed might have virtue in it because it was Elisha's bed. That sounds sort of superstitious. I don't really believe that's why she did it. Another reason she might have done it is suggested by Adam Clark, that perhaps she was imitating Elijah. If you recall the story when Elijah was at the widow of Zarephath's house. Zarephath is on the Mediterranean coast near Sidon. The widow of Zarephath's son was laid on Elijah's bed so Elijah could raise him from the dead. Maybe the Shunammite woman might have heard that story. That's very reasonable to me. I think Adam Clark's suggestion is reasonable. Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggest that maybe the reason she did it was to conceal the boy's death from her husband and family. She wanted to keep them from burying the boy before she had a chance to find Elisha. Now, it's a hot climate. The boy's not going to last too long before he starts decomposing. She had to find Elisha fast. And in a hot climate, you're probably going to bury a body fairly fast. And so she hides the boy's death from her husband as well as her family. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this concealment was quote-unquote heroic. Now, why did she shut the boy in the room? John Gill suggests it's probably to keep animals from eating the corpse if she'd have put the boy anywhere else, or to keep anyone from finding him if indeed she was trying to keep the boy from being buried. Now, I'm going to ask the question later. If you were a father and your wife knew that your son was dead and she didn't tell you, how happy would you be with that? I wouldn't. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 22 through 25. Then she, that's the Shunammite wife, she called to her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and return. He, that's the husband, said, why will you go to him? Why will you go to Elisha today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath. And his wife said, it will be well. Then she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, drive and go forward. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you. So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. When the man of God, that's Elisha, saw her at a distance, he said to Gehazi, his servant, behold, there is the Shunammite. Now the woman, concealing the death of the boy, tells her husband, I just want to run up and see Elisha. I'll come right back. I'll return. So the husband would think she would be gone only for a short time, which actually was true. She wasn't going to be gone long. The husband is curious. He says, well, why do you want to go see Elisha today? It's neither new moon nor Sabbath. Now, what does that mean? Well, there's two options. It could be, hey, it's not even the end of the month yet. You've seen Elisha just recently, and since Elisha has just left, it's not even come to the end of the month yet. You want to go see him again? He's here all the time. What's the big hurry? I say the end of the month because the new moon was at the beginning of each due month, and so that would be the reference to the new moon. It's not even the new moon yet, and so you want to go back and see Elisha? Or it's not Sabbath. You just saw Elisha, and Saturday hasn't even rolled around yet, and you already want to go back and see him? So what's the rush? Well, that's one option. Here's another option suggested by Gill and Adam Clark. Let me quote Gill. Quote, it seems it was usual to frequent the house of the prophet to hear the word of God read and explained and other religious exercises performed as praying and singing praise and receiving some good instructions and advice. In other words, New Moon and Sabbath is a special religious holiday or two special religious holidays, and the husband expected if you're going to go see a prophet, it would be on a religious holiday, and it's not. So what's the big deal? Why are you going? Why do you want to go see him? And she said, it'll be well. Well, she's covering up. She's not telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. She is deceiving her husband. Well, the husband didn't seem to complain when she said, it'll be well. She didn't answer him. I suspect she probably looked a little frantic and was probably in a hurry. The husband was pretty trusting to take this for an answer. Oh, yeah, it's going to be well, okay. She's not going to tell me, but that's okay. I'll just let her go. All right, my question is now, was the Shunammite woman a submissive wife? And I ask you, before I ask that question, is how would any husband feel if his wife had not told him his son was dead? How would you feel if you were the husband, if that somewhat important fact had been hidden from you? Well, I suppose at the happy ending of this story, the boy was raised, muted any concerns the husband might have had, and so if he was angry about it, his anger was overcome by the joy of seeing his son raised. But now consider the terrible risk this woman was taking if the boy was not raised. She comes back. The husband says, what's that smell coming out of Elijah's room? He opens the door, and there's his dead son there, and you didn't tell me, wife? Ooh. Now you talk about grounds for divorce, assuming the easy grounds in the Levitical law, assuming that's true, that would rank right up there with the grounds for divorce. She's taking a horrible risk by doing this. This shows that her faith was very, very strong. She believed that Elijah could raise that boy, and she believed in the Yahweh who was behind Elisha. Excuse me. She believed in the Yahweh who was behind Elisha. Now, she told her husband, it will be well. Or as the Holman Christian Study Bible says, everything is all right. Well, no, everything was not all right. That's getting close to a lie. That's not just concealing the truth. That's just basically telling a lie. It depends on how it's translated as to whether it's a lie or whether it's concealing a concealment. But either way, she wasn't truthful with her husband. Well, now, here are a couple of options as to what she meant when she says it will be well. Did she mean the boy will be physically well? She's thinking, of course, the boy. She's not saying anything about the boy to the husband, but I'm sure she's thinking to herself, it will be well. What will be well? Will the boy be physically raised from the dead? If so, she has a lot of faith, and I think that's what she thought. Or was she thinking that eternally it will be well because the boy is going to go to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the fathers in heaven when he dies? I don't think that's what she was thinking. Listen to what Adam Clark says about that. Quote, in her days, the doctrine of reprobate infants, that means infants who die and go to hell, the doctrine of reprobate infants had not disgraced the pure religion of the God of endless compassion. She had no doubts concerning the welfare of her child, even with respect to another world. And who but a pagan or stoic can entertain a contrary doctrine? Well, he's an Arminian. Of course, Arminians just can't stand the thought of that God might judge original sin, which is every infant that's born in the world is affected with. But it's interesting to me that almost all Calvinists today in the modern world believe that babies that die before they can think go to heaven. I hope it's true. But I want to tell you something. There's a lot of theological problems with that. A lot of problems, which I won't get into now. At any rate, I don't think that's what she's thinking about. She's thinking the boy is physically going to be well. So it says in verse 24, she saddled up a donkey. Actually, she probably had it done by the servant that's mentioned here. And she said to the servant, drive and go forward. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you. Now, there's a couple of options as to how she, the donkey, and the servant arranged themselves. First option is she didn't walk, but she rode on the donkey with the servant. That's highly unlikely. A woman's not going to ride on a donkey with her servant. Option number two, she sent the donkey and the servant on ahead for Elisha to ride back on just to speed things up. And then the servant was supposed to tell Elisha, get on the donkey, go to Shunem, there's a dead boy there, and then the servant would follow on back on foot. I don't think it's what happened. I don't think that's what happened. It could be. Jamison Fawcett Brown suggests this, the servant walked and the woman rode on the donkey. Clark agrees with that. Here's what Clark says, quote, it is customary in the East for a servant to walk alongside or drive the ass his master rides. Sometimes he walks behind and goads on the beast, and when it is to turn, he directs its head with the long pole of the goad. Jamison Fawcett Brown says this, quote, it is usual for women to ride on asses accompanied by a servant who walks behind and drives the beast with his stick, goading the animal at the speed required by his mistress. And I think that's what's happening here. And the woman is saying, let's go, let's go, let's go. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you. So she's arriving to Mount Carmel. Elijah sees her at a distance. He says to Gehazi, his servant, behold, there is the Shunammite. The Mount Carmel, of course, is near present-day Haifa. Haifa is on Mount Carmel, basically. If you look at the map of Israel, see the little northwestern jut that juts out into the Mediterranean Sea. That's what we're talking about. There used to be a school of prophets there, as John Gill says. He also says it's about 16 miles up it's 16 miles from Shunem. Shunem is in the Jezreel Valley, and Mount Carmel is at the top of the Jezreel Valley, northwest. And Jamison Fawcett Brown say it takes about 5 or 6 hours to ride on a donkey there. We go now to 2 Kings 4, verses 26 through 28. This is still Elijah speaking to Gehazi. Please run now to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? In other words, Gehazi, get on down there and ask her what's going on. Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child? And she answered, it is well. And that means she answered Gehazi when he got to her. It is well, which it wasn't, but that's what she said. When she came to the man of God to the hill, in other words, she came with Gehazi back up to Mount Carmel, and there was Elisha. She caught hold of Elisha's feet, and Gehazi came near to push her away, but the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is troubled within her, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. Verse 28, then she said, did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? Now, the reason Elisha asked Gehazi to ask the Shunammite woman, is it well with you, is because he suspected something was wrong. Why would the woman be leaving her home, coming unexpectedly, and apparently in a hurry? He knew there was something wrong. Now, when Gehazi got to the woman and she answered it as well, she had basically told a lie. It wasn't well, but she was in a hurry. She wanted to speak to Elisha. She didn't want to explain the situation to Gehazi. Well, maybe, but I could think she could say, Gehazi, I've got a problem. My son's died. I got to get to Elijah. And Gehazi would have sped himself up and gotten her to Elijah as quickly as possible. So I don't think it was smart for her to just lie about it. I wouldn't try to justify that lie. Sometimes you can justify a lie because it's a warfare situation or a life and death situation. I know Christians disagree on that. But I don't think this is one of those instances. She didn't have to lie here. When she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught hold of his feet. Now, that's to show reverent supplication. And the idea is, don't leave me, don't leave me. I've got a hold of your feet. You can't move until you give me an answer. Gehazi thought this was quite undignified for a prophet. He tries to push her away. He thought that the woman was dishonoring Elisha. Elisha, after rebuking Gehazi for that, says, hey, God has not told me what's going on. The Lord has hidden it from me. Now, this shows that prophets cannot turn on revelation like a light bulb. Sometimes they have to rely on natural means. Remember those prophets that used to search the Old Testament prophecies to see what it meant? Peter refers to them. They hear things from heaven a lot clearer than you or I do, but it's not like they're reading from a book, not like they're not seeing through a glass darkly. Actually, that kind of makes it more exciting when you see prophets come up with stuff. Now, in verse 28, the woman says something that sounds a little bit strange. Did I ask for a son from my Lord, from you, Elisha? Did I ask for a son from you? Did I not say, do not deceive me? She's referring to what she said back in verse 16, chapter 4. Elisha said, at this time next year, you will have a son in your arms. Then she said, no, my Lord, man of God, do not deceive your servant. In other words, that's too good to be true. Don't start talking to me about crazy stuff, stuff that's so miraculous that it's unbelievable. Don't do that. So what she's saying is, look, Elisha, I didn't come to you asking for a son. You volunteered and came to me and told me the son was going to be here. And now you're telling me your gift from God is now dead? How does that make any sense? Why would God give me a son just to take him away? We go now to 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 29 through 37. So Elisha said to Gehazi, tuck your mantle under your belt, take my staff with you, and go. If you meet anyone, don't stop to greet him, and if a man greets you, don't answer him. Then place my staff on the boy's face. The boy's mother said to Elisha, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So he, that's Elisha, got up and followed her. Gehazi went ahead of them and placed the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or sign of life. So he went back to meet Elisha and told him the boy didn't wake up. When Elisha got to the house, he discovered the boy lying dead on his bed. So he went in, closed the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Then he went up and lay on the boy. He put mouth to mouth, eye to eye, hand to hand. While he bent down over him, the boy's flesh became warm. Elisha got up, went into the house, and paced back and forth. Then he went up and bent down over him again. The boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Elisha called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman. He called her. Gehazi called the Shunammite woman, and she came. Then Elisha said, pick up your son. She came, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground. She picked up her son and left. Now, in verse 29, Elisha tells Gehazi, tuck your mantle under your belt. That's so that Gehazi could run faster to get back to Shunem. Take my staff and put it on his face. Now, it's apparent that Elisha is not at this time intending to go himself, or it's arguably so, as John Gill says. So he sends Gehazi on ahead, and he intended to pray, I'm sure, in addition to Gehazi's placement of the staff on the boy's face. Elisha, in other words, did not think that just laying the staff on the boy would magically cure him. And as a matter of fact, the failure of the staff to resurrect the boy showed that superstitious reliance on physical things like that was no substitute for prayer. Well, that apparently was his original intention, but the boy's mother says, no, you need to come. I'm not going to leave. I'm not going to unhook my hands from your feet unless you come with me. She apparently had no faith in Gehazi and Elisha's staff. And subsequent events seem to have confirmed her fears because the staff did not raise the boy. So Elisha rose up and followed after the Shunammite woman. He couldn't refuse her. She was a grieving woman, and of course, she'd been very kind to him. And so he says, okay, now of course Gehazi went on ahead because Gehazi's a young man, I'm sure, and he can run faster than an old man and a woman. You ask me how I know Elisha's an old man, to be honest with you, I don't know, except that we always think of prophets as old men. So at any rate, Gehazi ran on ahead, failed with the staff. Elisha gets there. He sees the boy lying dead. He closed the door. Why did he do that? Well, so no one could interrupt his prayers. Elijah did the same thing when he was raising the widow of Zarephath's son. He didn't want anyone to interrupt him as he was praying over the dead boy, and also he might want to prohibit someone from looking in and seeing a strange sight and wondering what's going on there. Verse 34, Elisha lays on the boy, mouth to mouth, eye to eye, hand to hand. Elijah did the same thing when he raised the widow of Zarephath's son in 1 Kings 17:21. Then he, Elijah, stretched himself out over the boy three times. He cried out to the Lord and said, "My Lord God, please let this boy's life return to him." So Elisha is imitating what his master did. Notice that Elisha used natural means as well as the miraculous. He conveyed his own natural warmth to the body as he lay on the boy. He blew into the boy's mouth to inflate his lungs. And I noticed this action made Elisha unceremonially clean because, you know, you're not supposed to touch dead people. You become Levitically unclean automatically when you do that. But there's no problem here because the ox was definitely in the ditch. Now, when it says that Elisha put his mouth to the boy's mouth, his eye to the boy's eye, and his hand to the boy's hand, that must have been sequentially he did that. He couldn't do it all at once. Elisha would be too tall for the boy if the boy is about 6 or 7 years old. So he does this, and the boy's flesh became warm. Now, he's not alive yet, but his flesh, life is coming back to him. His flesh became warm. But Elijah wasn't finished with his miracle. In verse 35, he got up, he went into the house, and started pacing back and forth, and then went back and bent down over the boy again. I'm sure it was eye to eye, mouth to mouth, and hand to hand. Why was he walking up and down in the outside of the room in the Shunammite woman's house? Why was he doing that? Here's some options. Poole and Benson say that Elisha was praying fervently, and that's how you do. That's what you do when you pray fervently. You walk up and down and pace. Well, if that's true, we notice something interesting here. This miracle was not done instantaneously. That miracle required importunate prayer. God is not a green genie in a lamp. It comes out, you rub the lamp, your wish is my command, this is my command, this is my wish, bam, and the Lord commands it. It's not like that. You have really got to pray hard, fervently, and consistently. The application to modern times, to our life in Christ, is of course quite obvious. But now some people say that Elisha was not praying fervently as he walked up and down. The pulpit commentator says he was in distress and doubt. Well, if that's the case, then that shows that even great men of God at some times in their life experience distress and experience doubt. The Cambridge commentator says that he was walking up and down in anxiety. Oh, so now they experience worry. Well, that, of course, is exactly opposite to what Ellicott, the commentator, says, that Elisha was walking up and down in intense excitement, expecting the fulfillment of his prayer. So he was either praying in faith or he was moaning and groaning because of his distress and doubt. I report, you decide. Now, by this time, of course, as Elisha's there, he's walking up and down, praying in the house, probably praying, or whatever he was doing. The husband, by now, is going to know, either by direct report from his wife, or Gehazi, or somebody, Elisha, somebody will have told him the boy's dead, and he's going to know. I wonder what he's thinking about that. How come you didn't tell me that, dear wife? The boy sneezes in verse 35, the second time Elisha went into him. Seven times he sneezed, thus clearing his head of fluids and so forth, which may have accumulated in his sickness and death, and the boy's okay. And the last verse of this story, verse 37, she fell at Elisha's feet, of course, to thank him, bowed to the ground, bowed to Elisha, picked up her son, and left. That makes it sound kind of abrupt, but I'm sure it was after taking her farewells with Elisha, she goes to be with her son. Now, a good application of this story is this. You give and God will reward your giving. She gave of her time and her money. She built a room for the prophet. She fed the prophet when he came by. She ministered to him, and look how God rewarded her. Not only a miraculous birth of the son, but a miraculous resurrection of the son from death. So we go now to verse 38 through 41, and we will look at another miracle of Elisha. This is the death in the pot miracle. Verse 38, when Elisha returned to Gilgal, there was a famine in the land. The sons of the prophets were sitting at his feet. He said to his attendant, as Elisha said to his attendant, put on the large pot and make stew for the sons of the prophets. One went out to the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine from which he gathered as many wild gourds as his garment would hold. Then he came back and cut them up into the pot of stew, but they were unaware of what they were. They served some for the men to eat, but when they ate the stew, they cried out, there's death in the pot, man of God. I just love that phrase, death in the pot. and they were unable to eat it. Then Elisha said, "Get some meal." He threw it into the pot and said, "Serve it for the people to eat." And there was nothing bad in the pot. Now, verse 38 says Elisha returned to Gilgal. That's not necessarily from seeing the Shunammite widow's son raised. At some point, he goes to Gilgal. What Gilgal is this? Well, first of all, why did he return to Gilgal? Remember, there's schools of the prophets scattered around through northern Israel. And Elisha was going on circuit to instruct, to encourage, and strengthen the other prophets, maybe even to confirm his office as a prophet by doing miracles, which we're going to see here at the end of this chapter. He does a couple of miracles. He returned to Gilgal. There's about four Gilgals on the map I have in front of me. I discussed this in the last audio. I'm going to assume that this is the Gilgal that's south of Shechem, about 10 miles, about 15 miles north of Jerusalem, about 6 miles or so north of Bethel. So this is the Gilgal in the hills of Ephraim between Shechem and Bethel, I think. I will say that the BibleAtlas.org map puts the Gilgal there with a question mark, but then it says 2 Kings 2-4. That's where we are now. So they are assuming that that's where Gilgal is, and I will too. There was a famine. It's time to eat. Elisha says to his attendant, that's probably the same Gehazi. He tells the attendant, put on the large pot. Well, there was 100 prophets. We'll see in a verse coming up here shortly. Verse 43, 100 prophets, so it's going to take a big pot. So one of the prophets goes out and gathers some herbs, and he found some wild gourds and put them in his garment, as much as his garment could hold. I'm sure he had that, had a piece of cloth in the front of his robe, and he would lift that robe up, or his tunic, and pick it up and put a bunch of wild gourds into the garment. What were those wild gourds? Well, Clark and Gill both think they are a plant called coloquintida, which I have never heard of. Let me read you what Clark says. These wild gourds were, quote, thought to be the coloquintida, the fruit of a plant of the same name, about the size of a large orange. It is brought hither from the Levant and is often known by the name of the bitter apple. Both the seeds and pulp are intensely bitter and violently purgative. That means it'll make you barf like crazy if you eat it. It ranks among vegetable poisons, as all intense bitters do, but judiciously employed, it is of considerable use in medicine. John Gill says of this, these wild gourds, quote, thought to be the same with coloquintida, the leaves of which are very like to a vine, of a very bitter taste and a very violent purgative, which, if not remedied, will produce ulcerations in the bowels and issue in death. Ooh, death in the pot. Now, one might be tempted to criticize this prophet for picking up wild gourds unaware, as the scripture says here, unaware of what those wild gourds were. How many times have you been instructed by your parents, don't just eat a wild mushroom, you see it out there, it could kill you. I know of a story when I was growing up. Some kids did that and came very close to dying. Ended up in the hospital having their stomach pumped. You just don't eat stuff that's growing wild because it can kill you. Well, okay, so that might be stupid, but remember, these are prophets who are in a famine, and it's when you're in a famine, beggars have a hard time being choosers. And so their guard might have been down a little bit about eating wild stuff. So Elisha, in verse 41, throws meal into the pot and cures the death and makes the stuff good to eat. Now, as Adam Barnes says, curing of the poison had nothing to do with the natural power of the meal. This was a miracle because meal's not going to wipe out something as nasty as Gill and Clark says it was. Something is deadly. No, meal's not going to do that. So this was a miracle. Gill says this, quote, though this might in some measure, throwing the meal into the pot, might in some measure correct the strong, acrid, and purgative quality, yet it was only a miracle which could make a lapful of this fruit shred into pottage salutary. Fancy way of saying, took a miracle for that meal to make the poison go away. Now, why did Elisha use meal to do this? If it had no natural effect or very minor effect, why would Elisha use the meal? The Cambridge Commentary answers that question by saying this, quote, Elisha employs something which is wholesome and nourishing as a sign of the change that was to be wrought in the pottage. Prophets loved symbolism. They loved object lessons. We go now to 2 Kings 4, verses 42 through 44, and we will finish this audio. A man from Baal Shalishah came to the man of God with a sack full of 20 loaves of barley bread from the first bread of the harvest. Elisha said, "Give it to the people to eat." But Elisha's attendant asked, "What? Am I to set 20 loaves before 100 men?" "Give it to the people to eat," Elisha said, "for this is what the Lord says. They will eat, and they will have some left over." So this was a prophetic word from Elisha to the other prophets. Verse 44, "So he," that's Elisha's attendant, probably Gehazi, gave the 20 loaves of bread, as the Lord promised. They ate and had some left over. 100 people ate 20 loaves, and they still had some left over. So this man from Baal Shalisha, it's a great name for a place, but nobody knows where it is. Easton says it's apparently not far from Gilgal. He brought barley bread from the first bread, as the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, the NASB, has the first fruits of the harvest. Gil says it was first fruits. I was thinking it might just be somebody brought some barley bread, baked some barley bread, and brought it to the people, and just happened to be from the first fruits of the harvest. But no, this was the religious first fruits. According to Adam Gill, quote, "It was now barley harvest, and this was the first fruits of it, which, according to the law," Leviticus 23:10, "was to be brought to the priest. But being forbid in the land of Israel going up to Jerusalem, religious men brought their first fruits to the prophets." In other words, we don't have the temple anymore because of the Civil War and the secession of the northern kingdom, the northern 10 tribes from the southern 2 tribes. The people can't go down to Jerusalem anymore, so they just took their first fruits to the prophets. The commentator Benson and the commentator Ellicott both agree with Gill on that, and so I take that to be true. Now, Elisha must have been very thankful for this barley bread, because there was a famine going on. Anybody bringing them bread would be much respected and honored, I'm sure. The Holman Christian Bible says that the man from Baal Shalisha brought a sack full of 20 loaves of barley bread, full stop. But the New American Standard Bible says that the man brought 20 loaves plus fresh ears of grain. I don't know why they have such a difference in translation. Doesn't really matter. Now, Elisha was given this bag of barley loaves, and then he immediately gave it away. As freely as Elisha received, he freely gave. But of course, Elisha, he wants to take care of his prophets, and he relies on God to take care of his prophets. Same as Paul and the apostles, remember? Paul used to work to keep his apostolic band going. As we read, I think it's in Acts 20 when it says he did that. So this is a good application for today. If you have a ministry, it's your job, if you're in charge of it, to take care of the people in the ministry. And to do that, you better rely on God, supernatural supply, because there will always be famine and want in this screwed up world of ours. Well, when Gehazi, or whoever the attendant was, heard Elisha say, "Give the bread away," what? That's what he says right here in the text. What? I'm supposed to give 20 loaves to 100 people. Are you serious? Elisha, without hesitating a millisecond, says, "Give it to the people to eat, Gehazi. Give it to them. Because God has told me they will eat and have some left over." Ah, I have some left over. Does that sound similar? It sounds similar to Jesus' 2 miracles, the feeding of the 4,000 and the feeding of the 5,000 in the wilderness. The difference being is that Jesus' miracles were much bigger than Elijah. 4,000 and 5,000 is a lot more than 100. That's similar to the fact that Elijah's resurrection of the Shunammite boy from the dead was similar to Jesus' miracles of raising from the dead, except that Jesus' resurrection miracles were bigger. He did more of that than did Elisha, the widow of Nain, Lazarus. Adam Clark says this, quote, "This prophet, Elisha, might be more aptly considered a type of our Lord than most of the other persons in the scriptures who have been thus honored." In other words, Elisha is giving the Old Testament saints a foretaste of what's coming, just as we have a foretaste of what's coming when we see Jesus' earthly ministry. It's going to get better and better and better. His power is going to completely overcome death and sickness and famine and poverty and hunger and disease and you name it. Ladies and gentlemen, on that supremely happy note, we are now finished with 2 Kings chapter 4. That prepares us for our next chapter, which is 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 through 27. We will see Naaman, the Syrian general, healed of leprosy by Elisha as his miracles continue. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.